From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds in the KUOW Performance Studio with Pulitzer Prize winning writer and MacArthur genius, Jared Diamond.
Hi, Jared!
Oh, there's a studio audience here also. What a surprise. We're going to hear more from them later on in this hour. Jared Diamond's books provide a theory explaining on why civilizations collapse and why it is that some civilizations gain power and sophistication while others did not. Those books include Collapse and Guns, Germs, and Steel. Jared Diamond is a professor of geography at UCLA. His latest book is titled The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn About Traditional Societies. A great pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I think it's important to get the sense of what you mean by the yesterday of the title, The World Until Yesterday.
Yesterday is relative. Humans have been around for 6 million years, and advanced humans have been around for a couple of 100,000 years, but state government and writing has been with us for only 5,000 years, and then technology has been with us for a century or so. And so by the standards of 6 million years, traditional societies, hunter-gatherers who didn't have kings and didn't have writing, they were here until yesterday, that's to say 5,000 years ago. But also in the United States today, lots of people are still living partly traditionally.
Where do you draw the line between traditional societies and modern societies?
It's arbitrary. It's like the arbitrary line between a small meal and a big meal. But a traditional society at the one extreme is a small-scale society of a few dozen up to a few hundred people that is sedentary, doesn't have kings, doesn't have inequality, doesn't have writing, and because there aren't kings or centralized government, is almost constantly involved in warfare. That's traditional societies, and that was, in fact, everybody in the world until 10,000 years ago.
And certainly in the last century, we've seen the decline of traditional societies as civilization has encroached more and more upon them. Is there some point at which a traditional society has to give up that title because it's been infused with so much of the civilized, but the developed world?
Once a traditional society encounters the outside world, and that happened suddenly in New Guinea over the last century, where New Guineans who didn't know that there was an outside world suddenly were confronted by it when Europeans arrived. Immediately, a traditional society starts to change simply from the knowledge that there's an outside world. And then once they acquire steel axes instead of stone axes, once they acquire matches, and once a colonial government comes in and says, stop fighting each other and stop being cannibals, so the traditional world has already started to change. But my New Guinea friends who had first contact within the last few decades, there's still a lot traditional about their lives.
You've got a great picture in The World Until Yesterday of some traditional peoples encountering white people for the first time, and they have an utter look of terror on their face. It's though monsters have just arrived.
I recall an occasion when I was in a remote village in New Guinea where probably no European had been into the village, although the people, the older people, had been out of the village and seen Europeans. And so while I was in the village, there was a mother carrying a little baby, and the mother turned around so the baby faced me. And within 2 seconds, I could just see this look of absolute horror on the baby's face, and then the baby breaking into uncontrollable, horrified crying. That was first contact for the baby.
Wow. One of your goals in The World Until Yesterday is to get us out of our weird perspective of human psychology, and you're using WEIRD as an acronym. What is the acronym you're talking about here?
The acronym WEIRD, which was coined by an anthropologist at UCLA and a couple of sociology colleagues. WEIRD, W-E-I-R-D, or is it W-I-E?
Yes, E.
W-E-I-R-D.
Western, educated,
industrial, rich, democratic. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that's what we are, and that's what the first world is today, but nobody in the world was Western, educated, industrial, rich, democratic, really until the last couple of centuries. And the reason for calling us WEIRD is that by the standards of traditional humans for millions of years, and by the standards of most people 500 years ago, we are WEIRD.
And getting us out of that perspective, there's some surprising things you write here about traditional societies. I suppose it's my WEIRD perspective, but you write that traditional societies are far more diverse in their cultural practices than modern societies.
Once you have a state government every state government, whether it's American, Israeli, Argentine, or Chinese, every state government wants some of the same things. Every state government wants its citizens to be peaceful and not killing each other. Every state government wants its children to be raised so that they'll be loyal citizens and loyal soldiers. Just as every state government wants its citizens so not to get into fights. So, for example, you and I had never seen each other until half an hour ago. And in this half hour, I have not made a move to kill you. You've not made a move to kill me. But in New Guinea, this would be unthinkable.
Well, there's still 30 minutes, so you never know.
In New Guinea, it would have happened much earlier.
Well, and you really draw this out in an interesting way at the very beginning of The World Until Yesterday. If you just tuned in, Jared Diamond is my guest. And in the new book, he talks about what we might be able to learn from traditional societies. And the dramatization of it, it starts out in an airport terminal, and you point out how remarkable it would be in centuries past and eons past for humans to come together like that, because no one knows anyone in an airport terminal.
That's true for an airport terminal. And again, I'll give you another vignette. A friend of mine who was a missionary pilot was the first person into a remote tribe in New Guinea at a time when the tribe of a few dozen clans of a few dozen people was having a gathering that takes place once a year. And he said that this occasion was absolutely terrifying because clans that saw each other once a year, here would come this strange person that you heard of or that you saw once a year, and there was the person who had killed your uncle, or there was the person who had abducted your sister's cross cousin. And so in this meeting, people who didn't know each other or saw each other really, every now and then someone would grab an axe and rush at someone else to kill him and had to be restrained by other people. So it was terrifying. And here, what we have here, again, many of you are strangers to each other and nobody has made a move to kill each other and nobody has run out screaming in terror. This would be impossible in New Guinea.
You give another great example. You tell the story of going on a bird-watching trip you took to an area populated by some rival tribal groups, but they had kind of become frenemies, like friendly enemies in some ways. They negotiated a way to live next to one another, to allow passage through one another's territory and not antagonize each other, although they considered one another to be enemies.
Yeah. Neighboring groups in New Guinea are sedentary. The people next door are going to be there for your lives, and they've always been there. And so there are fluctuating conditions of peace and warfare. In the particular story that I related that begins my chapter one, I happened to be in the middle of it. I was with a group of New Guineans. I wanted to bird watch. I said, this is a great campsite. They said, okay, but don't walk 2 feet off the trail. Why not? The perfectly good forest. Well, that belongs to the other people, and they are our enemies. But it turned out to be complicated because, yes, the man with me said that he had seen his uncle killed by these people. But at the same time, on my second day there, a group of these people came down the trail, and I thought, oh, my God, we're cornered. We're going to get killed. But no, they've got the right to come down the trail as long as they don't go off the trail and get wood or water. And in the village of my friends, there were two people from the enemy group who had married into that village. So there's this complicated rules of what you can do and what you cannot do. You can interview me, but you had better not ask to marry my sister.
I'm married, so that's not any risk of that taking place at the moment. There's also a great way you relate about how this is negotiated in traditional societies. If we were in a traditional society and we met each other here, I might start asking you about your background in Brookline and who your relatives were. And I might tell you about how I grew up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and who my relatives and friends were. And as you related, at some point, maybe we'll make a connection, but we might take a long time to get to that connection.
You and I, in fact, have already done that, and that's an example of how in our weird modern societies, we incorporate a lot that's traditional. Very quickly, you and I figured out that we were both from Massachusetts, and you mentioned having gone to university in Worcester, and so I could relate to Worcester because my house was on a road that led to Worcester. So that means that we've got something in common, and we're less inclined to kill each other, certainly less inclined to be hostile. In New Guinea, if you run into someone in the jungle whom you've never seen before, that can be very dangerous. And if you cannot run away, then the two of you sit down, and you have a conversation that may last 2 hours, in which you name all your relatives in the hope that you find some person that is a relative in common. And if so, then you have no reason to kill that person. But if after 2 hours you find that you don't even share a third-degree cross-cousin, then one of you had better run away because there's going to be a fight.
This kind of relates to another thing that you draw about traditional societies, their talkativeness. You spent a lot of time among them in Papua New Guinea, and you said it's impossible to get to sleep at night sometimes because the traditional people are up nattering away all night. What are they talking about all the time?
They're talking about anything. They're having a running conversation about everything that's gone on that day, about what everybody did. For example, the first New Guinea group that I worked with, I picked up something of their language so I could hear what they were talking about. And I remember once being in camp where I was there alone and there were two of these New Guineans, and what they were talking about was whether the red man, that's to say me, I'm not a white man, but a red man, whether the red man had urinated that morning and where and how many sweet potatoes there were and how many sweet potatoes you ate and how many sweet potatoes the red man had eaten and would the red man buy us more sweet potatoes. This just went on and on. It's a running commentary on everything that is happening.
And that kind of points out something. Loneliness and isolation in modern society is a real common issue, but you note that loneliness is not really a problem in traditional societies. Is that because of this continuous dialogue that goes on?
Partly it's because of the dialogue, but even before that, it's because in a traditional society, you're always surrounded by your relatives and your friends with whom you've grown up and spent your life. In traditional societies, people don't move except in marriage. And when they move in marriage, they'll visit their natal society. So they're not lonely because they spend their lives with their friends and relatives. And in addition, they're not lonely because they're not plugged into a computer 7 hours a day or sitting in front of a TV screen, but they're nattering constantly.
Now, you don't overly romanticize traditional cultures. You point out many of the advantages of state society, the societies that we're in today, and how we've really appreciated that. But some might still be skeptical. They might ask, well, traditional societies have all but died out. They've kind of been losers in the competition to state-run societies. What could we possibly learn from them?
That's a good question, and it's a key question that I'm glad you asked that because it often comes up. It is true that traditional societies have, in a sense, lost out in competition to state-level societies. And the reasons that they've lost out are very specific, that the state-level societies had standing armies, they had guns, they had steel, they developed germs, they have large populations of millions instead of a few dozen. So traditional societies colonized New Guinea rather than New Guinea colonizing Europe. But the fact that we, Americans and Europeans, have guns, germs, and steel doesn't mean that we have better ways of bringing up children. It doesn't mean that we are more sensible about recognizing dangers. Doesn't mean that we are healthier. Doesn't mean that we treat our old people better. In fact, in all those respects that I mentioned, there's a lot that we can learn from traditional societies, even though we conquered them for specific reasons.
And let's break that down a little bit, because here's kind of the core of the book, is what could we learn from traditional societies? And one of them, as you mentioned, is the way that we treat the elderly. What do traditional societies have to teach us about that?
That's a subject of current personal interest to me, since my 75th birthday was some months ago, and I care. And I remember that when I was a teenager, I remember looking up at there was a married couple who were 28 years old, and I thought, my God, they're mature, they're at the peak of life, and somebody who was 50, that's old, and somebody who was 70 was over. Now at age 75, I think I'm at the peak of life, and maybe when I'm 90, 95, I'll be old. So the reality is that anybody who has older parents or grandparents, you know that old age is a disaster area of American life. Older Americans tend to be lonely. They certainly are undervalued. If they want jobs, they have difficulty getting jobs. If you go to a hospital, if you need medical care, and you go to a hospital and there is one bed for two people, the bed is going to be assigned to the 18-year-old, not to the 80-year-old. So the reality is that older people have a hard time in not just American society, but in most weird societies compared to traditional societies.
Well, but do they do it better in traditional societies? There's the story, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, about how in northern climates you just put the old people out on the iceberg and send them out when you're ready to be rid of them.
That's true. And again, it illustrates a crucial point. You mentioned earlier that I think that we should not either romanticize traditional societies, nor should we despise them. There are things that they do to which we say, thank God. Traditional societies, those that are nomadic, have no choice except to abandon or kill or encourage to commit suicide their older people. But sedentary traditional societies usually offer their older people a much more satisfying life than in the United States, because older people have value. They're the repositories of knowledge, they're the best at making tools, and they're surrounded by their friends and relatives.
But in our society, that's not necessarily true. The repository of information is in libraries and on cell phones and in computers, and the older are not necessarily the most skilled at making tools. How do we retain their value in modern society, drawing upon these traditional societies' values?
It's a good question, and it's a sensitive issue. To a first approximation, one might say that older people lack the skills that the younger people have acquired. And so, for example, when I would like to turn on a television set at home, I grew up in 1948, was the first television set in Boston, and there were three dials, the volume knob and the channel knob and some other knob, and I could manage those three knobs. Now, to turn on the television set in my house, there is this wretched 41-button remote, and I've taken lessons on it, I've written down, and still, to turn on the wretched TV set, I have to call my sons and have them talk me through it every time. That's an example of my knowledge being out of date. On the other hand, older people have gone through experiences that younger people have not. We older people have lived through world wars. We've lived through the decision of whether it's worse to drop atomic bombs than not to drop atomic bombs. We've gone through the financial crises of the 70s and 80s. We've gone through what it was like to be afraid of nuclear war. Some of us have gone through the Great Depression. And because we've got experience of that, we have a perspective that the young whiz kids don't. That's something that particularly interests me, because occasionally I'm asked to talk to hedge funds. And when I speak to these groups of hedge fund employees, most of them are in their 20s and 30s. And when you hear about the career of the average hedge fund, most hedge funds fail within the first 5 years. And they fail because the whiz kids do very well for a few years, and then there comes something of which they have no experience, so the hedge fund fails. But in a hedge fund that has a few people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, those are the people who can prevent the hedge fund from failing. So there's an example of how older people are of great value in our economy.
You're listening to KUOW, and we're talking today with Jared Diamond. His new book is called The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. We're going to take a short break, and when we continue, we'll kind of follow up on some of the benefits he sees from taking a look at these societies and seeing where they have succeeded. He's, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning and best-selling author of Collapse, and Guns, Germs, and Steel, and a MacArthur Fellow. And our studio audience is going to have some questions for him, too, coming up. We're going to take a short break right now. From KUOW, I'm Ross Reynolds. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds in the KUOW Performance Studio with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Jared Diamond.
Hello.
Hello. No, louder. All right. That's our studio audience, and they're here listening attentively. We're going to give them a chance to ask some questions, too. Jared Diamond, you know him from the books that he's written, Collapse, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and he really takes on an interesting project in his newest, The World Until Yesterday, looking at traditional societies. What can we learn from them, even though they have been beaten down and exist in some ways, but not certainly not the way they did for thousands of years of our history? And one of the ways, Jared Diamond, that you talk about benefits that we might get from looking at the way that traditional societies settled things was specifically in dispute resolution, in figuring out what goes on if a child dies accidentally. In this world, there'd be insurance companies involved, there'd be police involved. How do traditional societies handle those kind of dispute resolutions, and what might we learn from them?
They handle dispute resolutions both in a much happier way than we do, and if that doesn't work, in a much unhappier way. If they cannot succeed in settling the dispute. Then, because there's not a central government with courts and police, it goes to warfare. And warfare means ongoing cycles of revenge warfare. That's the bad part. The good part is that if there's a dispute, and one case that I experienced secondhand was a dispute arising from a child being killed in a car accident, when there's a, quotes, dispute like that between the relatives of the parents of their dead child and the driver who had killed their child, in the United States you would go straight to the police and you would be filing a lawsuit. But even if you won the lawsuit, you would be churned up for the rest of your life with angry feelings, upset feelings over the death of your child. And the driver would be probably churned up for life over feelings of guilt. But in this case in New Guinea, the way it was dealt with was an attempt to achieve emotional clearance. New Guinea dispute resolution is not about right and wrong. It's about putting it behind you emotionally. And so in this case, there were discussions to intermediaries, and 5 days after the death, incredibly, the employer and the fellow employees of the driver sat down for a meal with the mother and father and uncle and relatives of the dead boy. The employer of the driver brought along money and food as compensation, and they cried together. The employer of the driver made a speech, which he said was the hardest speech that he had to make in his life, because he was addressing the mother and father, and he said, here, I'm giving you this money and this food, but I know this is rubbish because I've got two children of my own. I know what you're going through by thinking of the death of my own children. So he was crying, everybody else was crying, and they put it behind them. They were not churned up for the rest of their lives. In the United States, there would instead be a lawsuit, and regardless of who won, people would be miserable for the rest of their lives.
You know, that makes me think of the situation with a doctor that might make a mistake and might want to apologize to a family for a mistake that was made, but because of our legal system doesn't dare do it because they would be opening themselves liable for a lawsuit, but kind of denying sort of a human moment that might make, be very important to the people who've been wronged. But are there any examples you can see of places in our society or Western society or developed society where these messages of how traditional societies resolve disputes in this fashion have actually taken hold?
Yes, and one is the example that you just mentioned, doctors who make a mistake. The normal practice in the United States has been that the hospital and the doctor cover it up and deny responsibility and certainly don't apologize. But recently there's been attempts to see what happens if the doctor does apologize. These are attempts, but the result so far is that if the doctor apologizes and shares the grief of either the patient or the relative, there is much less likely to be a lawsuit than if the doctor does not apologize. So there's an example.
You also write quite a bit about child rearing and how that's done in traditional societies compared to the way it is today. What can we learn from the way they do it?
There's so much that we can learn from the way they do it. Some of it is banal. When you carry your infant, most of us in the United States, certainly my wife and I, when we're carrying our infants, we either push them in a baby carriage, in which case the infant is horizontal, looking away from the direction of movement, or the infant may be vertical in a pack but is likely to be facing backwards. In traditional societies, kids are always carried vertically. Infants are always carried vertically upwards, looking forwards. The result is that the kid sees where it's going. It has a sense of being in control. It has a sense of sharing the same field of vision of the parents, not just being a passive creature being transported. And a consequence is that it appears that in at least some traditional societies, kids acquire neuromotor skills, walking, standing, earlier than in our society. But this also contributes to the sense of security and self-confidence and independence that strikes me about New Guinea kids and that strikes every visitor that I know to traditional societies, whether they're New Guinea or African society. These kids there at age 5 or 10, they're self-confident, they make their own decisions, they come up to an adult and they'll talk with the adult. I remember one 10-year-old who volunteered to be a porter for me. His parents weren't around, but a 10-year-old can make his own decisions, so he went off for a week with me and then he stayed away for a month and he knew that somebody would tell his parents that he had gone off with some white man who knows where. But from his parents' point of view, a 10-year-old is capable of making his own decision. And the result is that they end up self-confident, assured, happy, less plagued, certainly not plagued by the adolescent crises that are a ubiquitous problem of American society.
One of my favorite sections of The World Until Yesterday is where you just have quotes from people mm-hmm. who came from largely traditional societies to developed societies, to Western societies, to state societies. And their quotes about what it meant to come to these societies is really revealing, kind of some amazing things. One of them said, nice kids don't do well in modern societies.
There were a lot of these touching quotes. I have quite a few friends who grew up in New Guinea because they were parents of missionaries or business people, or they grew up in Africa. And then as teenagers, they came to the U.S. or Europe for late high school or for universities. Coming to the U.S. or Europe was traumatic for them. There were things that they liked. They liked chocolate and various other things. But things that made them miserable were the fact, as one of my New Guinea friends put it, he said, American kids go into their houses and close the doors and watch TV, whereas in New Guinea, all of us kids were out in the village playing. Another one of my New Guinea friends said, in the village, every adult in the village was an aunt or uncle to us, and we had dinner each evening at whichever hut we happened to be at that evening. Which means that there were all these alternative social models, not just your parents. And I think that's part of the reason why kids in New Guinea and Africa grow up more socially skilled. It was summed up by what a friend of mine who has worked a lot in the Central African Republic said about Africa. Central African Republic is a really poor country, and today it's in political turmoil. But he summed it up by saying, life in Africa is socially much richer, although materially much poorer, than life in the United States.
Jared Diamond is my guest. We're talking about what we might learn from traditional societies. And as you've mentioned, traditional societies can be very warlike, and that might be not be something we'd want to emulate. But you also say, as a kind of a counterexample to what we might learn from it, that the modern state, which we often think of as a driving force behind killing, behind World War II, behind Hiroshima, behind genocide, actually provides benefits over traditional societies in the way that we handle warfare?
That's surprising, and to many people, it's obscenely offensive. To suggest that modern states that perpetrated Auschwitz and Hiroshima and the mass killings of World War II, to suggest that modern states have advantages as regard warfare compared to traditional societies. But surprisingly, it's true. When you look at the numbers, that if you're a citizen of a modern state, and take the worst cases, if you were a citizen of Poland, Germany, or Russia in the 1940s, your chances of dying a violent death were nevertheless lower than if you are a citizen of the vast majority of traditional societies around the world. And the reason is simply that modern states can declare war, but they can also end a war. And when they end war, that's it. Whereas traditional societies without a central government, they're locked in these endless cycles of warfare.
And Steven Pinker, who sat where you're sitting right now, also came to talk to us about what he saw as the decline of violence, partly attributable to what you're talking about. If you just joined us, Jared Diamond is my guest here in the performance studio at KUOW. We have a studio audience, most of whom have read some of his books. And I understand some of you have some questions, either about what we've just been talking about or perhaps some of his earlier work. Yes, sir. What's your name and what's your question?
Dennis Graves. Professor, to follow up on Ross's question about how modern societies have, in some ways, advantages in warfare, how do you explain to someone from New Guinea, from an indigenous society, when they have questions about how we do warfare, what we go to casus belli for wars of territory and for nationalism and for religion and wars of class structure? How do you explain us to them? Do they even have a sociological point of view to understand it?
I'll give you a vignette as an answer to that, and this is not my vignette, but it's a vignette of a well-known anthropologist called Napoleon Chagnon, who has worked among the Yanomamo people of Brazil and Yanomamo Indians of Brazil and Venezuela, who are notorious for being warlike and fighting a lot. And Napoleon Chagnon happened to be mentioning So there were some Germans in the vicinity. He's American. Somehow the subject came up of war between Germany and the United States. And so the Yanomamo chief who was with him said, oh, so there's war between your tribe and that tribe. I suppose it was about that they kidnapped one of your women. So that the assumption is that war is about these personal issues, not about political issues, but about personal issues, particularly the stealing of women or the stealing or killing of pigs, and also then ultimately about disputes over territory.
Another question for Jared Diamond? Yes. Who are you? You don't have a question. He does have a question. Your name, sir?
Kim Peterson. And talking about stealing women, how is traditional society different from weird societies in the treatment of women?
Oh, how a traditional societies different from modern societies in the treatment of women. The reason that I said, oh, was that my middle-level class at UCLA has been a tryout for my books. And so I was thinking of including in my current book, The World Until Yesterday, a chapter on the treatment of women in traditional societies. And I decided not to put that material in my book because the women students in my class were so upset and unbelieving and angry that I decided I'd better not write about it. The cruel reality is that there is no traditional society in which women are equal or nearly equal. In some societies, women may be equal in some area, such as having a say about children, and unequal in other areas, but by and large, in all known traditional societies, women are far from equal, and the treatment of women is usually, I would say, worse than even in modern American society. In New Guinea, traditional New Guinea, when I began working there in the 60s, women were sold. Women, and also the young men, did not have a say in who they were going to marry. But the woman was sold by her clan to the other clan. And in my second year in New Guinea, a young New Guinean, 18 years old, whom I had gotten to know reasonably well, he had just caused a scandal because a teenage girl who was about 15, whom he liked and she liked him, she had been promised at birth to an old man, and now she's 15 years old, and so it's time for consummation of the marriage. The man has already paid his money. And the night before the forced marriage, she runs off to the hut of my friend, which causes a scandal. But there were Australian patrol officers, and the Australian patrol officer said, this is a no-good custom that you got to be through with. Give the money back, and she can marry whom she wants.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Adrian Hobden. How large can a traditional society become, and conversely, what causes one to fragment?
How large can a traditional society become? That's a very interesting question. And there's a continuum. Traditional societies start out, the smallest of them would be a few dozen people, and we call that a band. And as the society gets larger, a few hundred people, we may call it a tribe, but there's still no king or chief. Everybody knows everybody. Then when the society is a few thousand people, there are strangers. You got to have a mechanism that ensures that a stranger won't kill another stranger. So you got a chief. And then once you get to be 50,000 people, you need not only a chief, but also bureaucrats, which means a state government. So in answer to your question, there's a continual gradation from traditional bands to traditional states. Do you want to say that Japan is no doubt it's been a state ever since AD 700, but there's a lot that's traditional about Japan and that still is traditional today.
That leads me to a question that I had about whether some of the benefits you see from looking at traditional societies are scalable to larger societies, or are they really things that can only operate with a smaller social system?
That's, again, a crucial question, and many people, when they hear about the content of my book, begin by objecting, quite correctly, that there are some things in traditional societies that we just can't adopt in our own society. For example, if all the kids on the block, if all the houses on the block have television, and if you believe that children should not have passive entertainment, and you don't have television for your kids, what's going to happen, we've seen it among our kids' friends, is that your kids are going to spend their time in those houses with television. So it is difficult to do some things that run counter to the trends of society. But what you can do, regardless of what anybody else does, messages from traditional societies are that there are big advantages not to spanking your kid. Regardless of whether your next door neighbors spank your kids, you don't have to spank your kids. And also there are advantages to carrying your kids upright facing forward. Even if your neighbor has a baby carriage and pushes the kid in a baby carriage, you don't have to do that. So in short, there are some things that we can adopt easily. There are some things that we can adopt with more difficulty as individuals, and there are some things that only the central government can do, such as changing the court system.
Jared Diamond, you write popular works for a broad audience, but you are an academic at UCLA where you're a professor. Sometimes academics get on your case for particular issues, but you give as good as you get. I've seen you say that, you know, a lot of academics don't do what they should be doing to get their message out to a wider audience. So do you think that they're slacking off in that fashion?
No, they're not slacking off because they never began. Slacking off implies that you began. The cruel reality is that academics are rewarded for publishing specialized papers. For years, I published specialized papers on gallbladder sodium transport, which were read by the world's four experts on gallbladder sodium transport, and I got promoted for that. But you learn to write in a way, technical way about gallbladder sodium transport. You do not learn to write in a way that the public can understand. But every year, scientists howl, complaining that the U.S. government and Congress people don't understand science. You're right, they don't understand science because scientists won't go to an effort to explain science in terms that lay people can understand. And unfortunately, those of us scientists who do try to explain science in terms that the lay people can understand, lots of academics, maybe even most academics, give us flack and consider that we're prostituting ourselves, and we're doing it because we're all washed up and our careers are finished. So since we didn't have anything else to do, we do this easy stuff, which is write children's stories for the public.
Ouch. Jared Diamond, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Conversation produced by David Hyde with Arwen Nix. Production help from Cameron Drews and Molly Williams. Thanks to Doug Patterson today. Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.